Earth. But what does this suggest to you? You know, if I asked you to close your eyes, now if you're listening to this in a car, you probably don't want to do that. But if you were to close your eyes and think geometry, you think shapes, you think forms, you think, don't you, of a certain sense of order, of balance, of harmony, of measure, of proportion. And don't all of those things sound awfully Greek? There's a tendency on some of these pots to reduce the shape of living things to geometric forms. A very common motif, for example, often around the neck of a Greek pot, is to have a series of deer all following one another, or stags, actually. And in each instance, the bodies of each deer are described in almost exactly the same way. It's a highly stylized kind of image. It's a very abstract kind of image. It is an image that abstracts something from the world around us, something from the familiar world that we see. It is to turn the familiar into what is even more familiar but less visible, that is to say, geometry. It is to suggest, in another way, that behind all that we see, there may be another realm, another kind of truth, another kind of beauty, another kind of perfection, of which all things in this world are but imperfect examples or suggestions or hints or possibilities. Now, we saw that, did we not, in connection with Zoroastrianism. I'm not trying to turn the Greeks into Zoroastrians. I'm not trying to turn the Zoroastrians into Greeks. I'm saying again, it is a common phenomenon, a common way of thinking about certain issues. But the next time you're in a museum and you see a Greek pot with these geometric designs or these highly stylized animal designs, think, stop and think, what do they suggest to you? What do they invite you to think about? And I think you'll see this sense that not everything is quite as we see it, and that there is a quest for order, balance, harmony, and proportion. Now, it's also very important to say that at a very early stage, the Greeks achieve a spectacular level of technical virtuosity in their sculpture, in their ceramics, in vase painting, eventually when they put pictures on ceramic and so on. So this is important too. And we'll come back to that point. Because with the Greeks, there is always techne. Techne is Greek for skill. There's always skill, accomplishment. But then there is the vision that informs the use of that skill. The Greeks are not alone in this. What is alone, what the Greeks are unique in, is the ways in which they put these two things together. Early Greek sculpture across this archaic period begins sometimes in stone, sometimes in bronze. The bronze figures obviously are cast, not carved. But early Greek sculpture begins to give us some interesting and important hints, about little differences between the way the Greeks think of the world the way some of their neighbors did. If you looked, for example, at Egyptian sculpture, if you looked at a good deal of Mesopotamian sculpture, if you looked at Hittite sculpture, one of the things you would see is figures that are rigid and frontal and unblinking, unfeeling, unchanging. What they communicate is all that does not change. There is again a sense of abstraction there. That's true. But with the Greeks, we begin to get, in a later lecture, we'll bring this more fully into view. But we begin to get a hint, a suggestion, that an image represents an actual person who walked upon the earth, who is distinctive, who is different from everybody else, who looks like that, and not like a rigid, lifeless, eternal kind of figure. So the Greeks have the capacity to be technically proficient, they have the capacity to look for abstraction behind the world we live in, and they have the capacity to observe very, very closely the world we live in. This blend, we will see later, is enormously positive and creative and generative. Now, let's go back to Homer's poems. We left off poor Homer as we were trying to extract from his poems certain things that we might be able to learn about the Mycenaean world. Now let's put Homer back in his own time and place, 800 to 700 BC in that period, and say, what do we see in these poems that may begin providing us hints about this polis that is just beginning to emerge, like late winter's first crocuses. Well, what we open up, I think, now, and I suggested this at the end of the last lecture, is a vista on ideologies, on values, but also, I think, some hints of that world's changes. Remember, we've talked about this period, 800 to 700, as transitional between the Dark Ages and the Archaic period. I think in the very Homeric poems, we can feel some of these changes. For instance, one of the things we find in the Iliad, you find these things in the Odyssey too, but I'm essentially focusing on the Iliad. One of the things that we find is intense competition. These Greeks are very competitive people. Now, we may think they, after all, invented the Olympic Games, and the Olympic Games happened every 4 years, but in the other 3 years, there were other games, the Isthmian, the Nemean, and the Panhellenic Games. So there were games going on in the Greek world all the time. Athletic means about prizes. You didn't play for the fun of it. The game was not the thing. Winning the game was the thing. These Greeks were competitive. Now, think of the soldiers in the Iliad. We have a picture of two great armies arrayed on a battlefield, but they're basically nameless and faceless to us, aren't they? What we have is two warriors. Our vision is always on two warriors. They come out on the battlefield and they make speeches to each other. They fight verbally before they ever strike a blow in earnest. And then they fight and they speechify and they fight and they speechify and they fight and they speechify. So there's physical competition and there's verbal competition. What would the Greeks have loved more than verbal competition? Somebody will be struck a mortal blow. He doesn't just die and kind of get himself off. He dies for 100 lines, making speeches, telling us. He's fighting with us sometimes, the audience.